Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank, focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
My, oh my, what a difference a couple of days makes. 280-something points on the Dow, a new record on the S&P. But hold everything for just one second here, because unless I miss my guess, not too long ago it was all doom and gloom. And what does it say that all it took to turn things around was some news that wasn't bad? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, supporting America's public transportation systems, working to help reduce greenhouse gases for a better environment at publictransportation.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Thursday. It's July 12th today, and when traders woke up this morning, there was no sign their day was going to turn out the way it did. There's been some tension in the markets lately. Subprimes, as we've told you about. Debt that private equity's piling on as it buys up everything in sight. But when major retailers reported halfway decent sales for June this morning, the buying spree was on. Chris Lowe is the chief economist at FTN Financial.
Whenever news comes into the stock market, it's all about expectations. And in this case, expectations were that we were going to get some really bad news today. And what we got instead was some okay news.
Okay then. 283 points on the Dow to the upside with news that's not so bad. Retail, though, is only part of the story today. There was also a company that's something less than a household name, Rio Tinto. It's agreed to buy Canada's big aluminum company, Alcan, for $38 billion. And if you ever needed proof of globalization's wide, wide reach, consider this. Here we have a company whose name translates in Spanish as Red River, but is actually a British-Australian concern which swooped in to outbid a U.S. company, Alcoa, and which is borrowing money from banks in Switzerland, Germany, Scotland, and France to get the deal done. So where does this leave Alcoa on the international stage? Marketplace's Bob Moon can't wait to tell us.
If only Alcoa could have waited. The Aluminum Company of America sold off its Canadian and international units back in 1928, creating a spinoff that became known as Alcan. Fast forward to 2007, and Alcoa decided it wanted Alcan back. 2 months ago, CEO Elaine Belda explained Alcoa's urge to merge and be aluminum's king of the hill again.
The new company will bolster competitiveness against increasingly large, low-cost suppliers from Russia, China, and elsewhere.
Now that Rio Tinto has snatched Alcan out from under Alcoa, the U.S. company will drop to third place behind Rusal, a Russian company. Lou Whiteman watches the metals industry for the deal.
So much of the growth right now is coming from Asia and coming from India, and a big, giant Russian producer, as well as growing producers in China and parts of Asia, has kind of put the North American companies on the defensive.
Whiteman says the situation has become all the more urgent for Alcoa, which may find itself the next takeover target.
They made that argument that they needed to grow to thrive. Now they're left without a partner. The argument might come back to haunt them that if they don't have this option to grow through Alcan, can they make it on their own, or would they be better as part of a more global, diversified company?
Alcoa formally withdrew its offer for Alcan this afternoon. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
There is an unusual twist today in what was shaping up to be a fairly routine antitrust case. The Federal Trade Commission has been trying to block the organic grocery chain Whole Foods from buying its smaller rival, Wild Oats. We learned this morning the FTC may have the ammunition it needs to do that because the CEO of Whole Foods has been quite vocal on an anonymous internet chat site. Marketplace's Sam Eaton explains.
It turns out John Mackey, the colorful co-founder and CEO of Whole Foods, had a fondness for online chatter. Not only does Mackey post regular entries on his company blog, but up until last year, he was also a frequent visitor to Yahoo's financial chat boards. Mackey used the pseudonym Rahodeb, a variation of his wife's name, Deborah.
The mere using of a pseudonym is not a violation of law.
former Securities and Exchange Commission lawyer Jacob Frankel.
The question is, for what purpose? And not only for what purpose, for what effect?
Mackey's anonymous postings repeatedly praised Whole Foods and bashed the company's primary rival, Wild Oats. In one comment, he speculated that the smaller chain would eventually be sold after sliding into bankruptcy. Frankel says these remarks could put Whole Foods' buyout of Wild Oats in jeopardy, especially if federal investigators can tie Mackey's postings to an actual drop in Wild Oats' stock price. But proving that could be tricky. Jeffrey Sonnenfeld with the Yale School of Management says the real casualty may be Whole Foods' reputation.
This guy is not one of the rogue CEOs who's out there plundering shareholder wealth. This guy had a sequential series of dumb attacks here. And I do think for this particular company has lost the legitimacy to lead.
Whole Foods is defending Mackey's actions. It issued a statement that the Rahodeb postings have been taken out of context and represent Mackey's personal opinions, not those of the company. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
We have links to some of the postings Rahodeb made on our website. It's marketplace.org. Also, a conversation I had with John Mackey a number of months ago. All the hoopla on Wall Street came despite rising energy prices, which helps this next story make some sense. The Russian energy giant Gazprom has announced a deal with the French company Total to help develop the largest natural gas field in the world. It's Stockman, up in the Russian Arctic. From the Marketplace European desk in London, Stephen Beard reports.
Total will sign a deal tomorrow, committing itself to study the Stockman project. On the face of it, it looks alluring. A 25% stake in developing a field with enough natural gas to power the whole planet for at least a year. But, says Nick Redman of the Economist Intelligence Unit, this won't be an easy project.
Deep into the Arctic, 25-meter-high waves. It's 500 kilometers away from the shore. This is a really hugely challenging gas field for anyone to take on. And that's why Gazprom definitely needed foreign help.
In spite of the challenge, five major foreign companies, including ConocoPhillips and Chevron of the US, have been scrabbling for a piece of the action. In the current political climate, the Americans stood little chance, says energy economist Philip Verliger.
The Russians right now are quite unhappy with the United States over the discussion of this missile defense system. They certainly aren't going to bend over backwards to help the United States.
But why did the Russians opt for Total? Nick Redman believes the French are prepared to strike other deals with Gazprom, allowing the Russian company a bigger foothold in Europe, a chance for Gazprom to further its own global ambitions.
It's also about developing its asset base abroad. Only then can Gazprom fulfill its destiny of being bigger than ExxonMobil.
Total, meanwhile, won't get any rights to the huge reserves in the Stockman field, only to what it pumps out for a limited period. The Russians are keeping tight control over their resources. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
As you might have gathered, it was quite a day on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Over here, it's just another day in the middle of July. Over in Northern Ireland, though, it's the height of what's called the marching season, when Protestants parade to mark the victory of King William of Orange over the Catholics back in 1690. Today, the two religions share power in a regional government, but with political peace come some questions about whether Northern Ireland's economy is due for an overhaul, too. From Belfast, Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
On the surface, Northern Ireland's economy is thriving. Unemployment is lower than the UK average. The Belfast skyline is transforming as the city undergoes a post-bombing building boom. Leo O'Reilly is budget director in the new power-sharing government. He says these positive signs mask the fact that Northern Ireland is dependent on the public purse.
We have public spending levels that far exceed the levels that, for example, now exist in the former East European communist states. So we have a very, very difficult position to address.
O'Reilly doesn't expect the flow of funds from UK central government to dry up all at once. The politicians don't want to undermine the peace, but he says it's bound to slow, and less funding would hurt the province disproportionately. A third of Northern Ireland's employees work in the public sector, versus a fifth for the whole of the UK. But expanding the private sector is a challenge, O'Reilly says. Pay and benefits there are worse than in the public sector.
Which means that young people with skills and talents are taken into the public sector and work there rather than moving into the private sector and using their skills to grow the economy.
Michael Smith teaches economics at the University of Ulster. He agrees that Northern Ireland must make the private sector a more rewarding place to work. For starters, he says, the region needs to attract financial services and high-tech firms. They'd bring more highly skilled, well-paid jobs. Both those industries have helped the Republic of Ireland double its economy in the past 17 years. But Smith says people in the north too often lack confidence in the region.
Northern Ireland's people are its own worst critics. You see, for 30 years, more than a generation, we haven't had to sell ourselves to anybody. Nobody wanted to come here while bombs and shootings were going on.
Money-making projects have languished for years. Take Northern Ireland's most famous product, the Titanic. Smith is overlooking the dry dock where the Titanic was built and from where she set out on her fateful maiden voyage. A couple of tourist signs are up in front of the old pump house, but the area still pretty much resembles an industrial wasteland. Looking down into the dry dock is like peering into a vast, rusty bathtub.
All you can say is there were very, very big weeds growing here, you know. I would say this, in any other country in the world that had a world emblem of despair, of hope, like the Titanic, they would be shouting it from the rooftops.
There are major plans for the site to be a tourist and business hub. Citigroup already has an office nearby. Smith says to get more international firms to invest in Northern Ireland, UK central government must allow the province to lower the tax companies here pay. It's currently 30%, as in the rest of the UK. That's more than double what companies pay in the Republic. Graham Brownlow teaches economics at Queen's University Belfast. He's sceptical that a lower company tax would do much to improve the North's economy.
It would do nothing to solve the problems of our long tail of unskilled workers. It would do nothing to rebalance the public sector with the private sector.
Brownlow says what's needed is better education, investment in research and development, and a genuine commitment to free markets. He doubts Northern Ireland's new government has that commitment.
They will pay a lot of lip service, I think, to free markets because it's currently necessary. But I don't believe that their heart's in it. And it's not a vote winner on the door.
Brownlow doesn't mean to sound unduly pessimistic. After all, Northern Ireland has overcome massive hurdles before. But shaking off this tradition of state bankrolling may take the same kind of courage it took to bring about peace. In Belfast, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Best guesses are that more than half of Afghanistan's GDP comes from the opium poppy crop, more than $3 billion in all. And evidence is mounting that that money is funding both the rise of the Taliban and the corruption of the government of President Hamid Karzai. U.S. forces, their NATO allies, and some private contractors have been charged with destroying the crop. The New Yorker's John Lee Anderson went along on a mission in the Taliban-controlled region of Uruzgan. And when we talked, I asked him about signs on the streets that the opium trade is in full swing.
There's a whole neighborhood in Kabul with these so-called poppy palaces, gaudy nouveau riche mansions that have sprung up in the past 2 years, which everyone credits with having come from the drug money. And plenty of officials in Karzai's government appear to be on the take. Let's put it that way.
Let me back up for a minute and get to the Taliban. When they were in control of Afghanistan, they essentially wiped out the opium crop, didn't they, the poppy harvest?
That's right. Eventually they did. It had flourished in the early years of the Taliban regime. But by 2000, they decided to move against it. And indeed, I think it was in early 2001 were actually credited publicly by the UN for having virtually eradicated the crop. However, as an insurgent force, once again, they have adopted the modus operandi of guerrillas everywhere, which is to tap into whichever natural resource gives them sustenance. And in this case, opium is the great cash crop of Afghanistan, and they have, by all accounts, forged agreements with opium farmers in order to tax part of the crop and in return protect their crops from American, i.e. coalition, i.e. enemy encroachment.
What are the mechanics of poppy eradication? The group you went out with, how did they do it?
This year, their second real year of eradication, what they did was go into fields with little ATVs. These are these all-terrain vehicles, a bit like hunters use in the States. And they have a couple of chains with an iron bar dragging behind it, and they literally drive back and forth through the poppy fields, knocking down the stalks. And then there's a team of other Afghan policemen who go around with broom handles and literally knock them down. It's quite primitive.
But it sets up a situation on the ground where you've got an Afghan farmer and his crop seeing that crop destroyed by possibly the first American or allied soldier he's ever seen.
Indeed. And in the case of the first day of eradication I went on, they simply began at one end and began working back, leaving the patchwork of wheat fields and other crops, watermelons, intact, but destroying the poppies. And, you know, I saw children gathered crying, very poor farmers gathered very angry. One of them in particular threatened the men. He said, "You should watch out. If you keep this up, you're going to pay for this."
Here we are, though, in 2007. The United States and its allies have been in Afghanistan for going on 6 years now. It was, for a while anyway, a bright spot in the war on terror, and now it's not going so well. How much of that is due to the opium trade and the revenue that the Taliban is getting from it?
There's clearly a relationship. There's entire districts which, to all intents and purposes, are ceded or have never been controlled or have been lost to Taliban by the central government. Now, why the great backsliding in Afghanistan? Well, as plenty of officials that I spoke to in Afghanistan are quite ready to admit, mostly off the record, our eye was off the ball. That is to say, the United States in particular invested a great deal of money and resources in Iraq very soon after the Taliban were chased back into the hills rather than being defeated. Very little was done in terms of reconstruction, visible projects, make-work projects in Afghanistan, which would have engaged the Afghan people. So in that void and in the lack of a muscular and visibly proactive central government, they have made and are continuing to make quite a bit of headway.
John Lee Anderson's letter from Afghanistan is in the current issue of The New Yorker magazine. Mr. Anderson, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, capturing the short attention span of shoppers and, yeah, journalists, too.
PR depends on stories. And once there's news out, then, of course, the media wants to go on to the next piece of news.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial swung up 283 points today, 2% to finish the day at an all-time high of 13,861. The Nasdaq pitched up 49 points, 1.8% to end at 2701, a multi-year high there. The S&P 500 batted up 28 points, 1.9% to close at 1547. That's another record high. Those sales figures had retailers dressed for success. Clothing store Abercrombie & Fitch sauntered up a cool 8.2%. American Eagle Outfitters flapped up 6.4%. The world's biggest retailer, Walmart, bulked up 2.4%. Chip makers were looking tasty today after strong sales predictions. After all, what doesn't have a chip in it these days? Intel clicked up 5.8%. Advanced Micro Devices, AMD, surged 4.8%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. Want to hear something on Marketplace again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and additional special features, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just head over to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for June. The International Energy Agency releases its monthly oil market report on supply and demand around the globe. And love comics? Dungeon games? Can't stay off the internet? Tomorrow is for you. It's Embrace Your Geekness Day. So just be yourself. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. News Corp Chief Rupert Murdoch is in the headlines all the time. There's that Dow Jones takeover thing. And just yesterday, he announced the launch date for his long-awaited business channel. Not too bad for a 76-year-old man. Murdoch could have retired years ago, but he isn't the only guy wheeling and dealing in his golden years. Warren Buffett's 76, too. Viacom Chairman Sumner Redstone's 84 and still going. The average age of Fortune 500 CEOs is 61. And commentator Harriet Rubin points out few of them are fading away as CEOs did a generation ago.
Business tends to be written on sand. It's constantly shifting. But these days, CEOs want to stick around to achieve something never before thought possible in business, immortality, a legacy. It's the wish to have something more than money to show for a life in business that separates mature leaders from young go-getters. Phil Knight, founder of the perpetually youthful Nike, was once asked, "What's your biggest fear about business?" Knight answered, "That one day I'll dandle a grandkid on my knee and she'll say, 'Grandpa, what was Nike?'" So mature leaders are forgetting Machiavelli's slim volume, The Prince. That primer on power was written for a feckless young Medici kid on how to beat the competition to a pulp. The new guides? Artists whose mature periods are called the late style. Late-style success goes against the market's demands. One creates, finally, for oneself and guarantees a legacy that way. Mature Bach bravely composed music for an instrument, the clavier, not yet invented. Mature Titian turned down commissions from wealthy kings wanting their portraits painted and painted emotional canvases of gods gone wild with his thumbs. Some mature business leaders appear ready, like artists, to have midlife rebirths instead of midlife crises. Take Phil Knight. He's painting with his thumbs, too, going from Nike into producing hip-hop operas in computer animation. David Leitch is leaving his lofty education post at the American Medical Association to pore over Aristotle's ethics. There's no buck to be made in ancient Greek, but Leitch wants to hitch his mortal wagon to a philosopher who's lived for thousands of generations and not an iPod nanosecond. These people are replacing the dominance of the younger boys in the room with the soulful maturity of the old masters. Forget 50 as the new 30. 50 is the new 150, going on 1,000 years, that is.
Harriet Rubin is the author of the book The Mona Lisa Stratagem. Send us your comments, no matter how old you are. Our homepage is marketplace.org. All you have to do is click on the link that says contact. According to the folks who track this kind of thing over at Nielsen, businesses spent $136 billion on advertising last year. That's a boatload of money in any case, more so when you consider how tough it can be to know whether advertising even works, not to mention this being the age of TiVo, when fast-forwarding through commercials has become an art form. So some retailers are turning to a related field to get consumers' attention, and they're hardly spending anything on ads at all. Our New York Bureau Chief Jill Barshay has the story.
Steve and Barry's is hardly a household name in fashion. It's best known for selling cheap tees, sweats, and sneakers. The company launched a new women's clothing line called Bitten last month. It primed the market by releasing a video on YouTube that featured one of New York's favorite celebrities.
Hi, I'm Sarah Jessica Parker, and you're watching SNB TV.
Parker's character on Sex and the City wore Chanel tops and Jimmy Choo stilettos, so discount clothing didn't look like a natural fit.
You know, I confess to not having known anything about the company. I, along with a lot of my friends, just were unfamiliar with Steve and Barry's.
Most of Parker's fans were probably unfamiliar with Steve and Barry's as well. The company hoped the video would change that. They wanted fans to discover the video on their own and email it around to their friends. And that was that. No TV commercials, no glossy magazine ads, no billboards. Howard Schachter, the chief partnership officer at Steve and Barry's, said he used no ads at all.
The primary communications tool that we use to get the word out is public relations. Sarah Jessica Parker and the Bitten brand in just the past month has appeared on the Oprah Winfrey Show for about a half an hour. She was on the cover of Glamour magazine.
The company even landed an 8-page fashion spread in Oprah magazine, but it paid nothing for the privilege.
To have 8 full pages in that magazine, the advertising equivalency would be about $800,000.
She was beautiful. So amazing. She's gorgeous.
Crowds mobbed Stephen Barry's New York City store in June when Parker showed up to sign autographs. Stephen Barry's public relations team arranged similar launch events all over the country. Parker only attended the one in New York, but Rachel Brenner, a Stephen Barry's PR official, had a special treat for some of the women in Texas who'd been waiting for 3 hours.
We surprised some of the first people in line with a phone call from Sarah Jessica.
Stephen Barry's repeated the cell phone shtick with early bird customers around the country. That generated many press conferences and even more stories in blogs and in the local press. Schachter says Stephen Barry's landed $50 million worth of free publicity last year. He says this year the company will double that. He says the all-PR approach is cheaper than buying ads, and it's more effective.
You're going to be much more apt to listen to that fashion reporter in your daily newspaper who says, I've tugged, I've pulled, I've looked, I've investigated. This is a great shirt. You should check it out. There's a lot more credibility coming in there than if we placed an ad in that newspaper that said, you know, we've got great quality product at great prices. You got to come on in.
But PR pros say it's dangerous to dump advertising altogether. Richard Adelman runs one of the largest PR firms in the country.
PR depends on stories. And once there's news out, then, of course, the media wants to go on to the next piece of news. PR can be the runway to trust, and then advertising can do the repetition and the reach.
So far, Stephen Barry's is thriving on PR thanks to Parker's star appeal and the seductive message that fashion can be affordable. But the approach could run out of steam. Almost a year ago, the company did a deal with basketball Stephon Marbury to sell $15 high tops. Marbury's star may have waned since then. Schachter admits he has placed a few ads in basketball magazines. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, military security in Iraq is the big priority these days. The president said exactly that during his press conference this morning. But banks could use a little beefing up, too. The Baghdad branch of Dar es Salaam Bank was robbed yesterday. Early reports had the take at $300 million, but the bank's owner, HSBC, by the way, said it was less than $1 million, all told. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow shot up 283 points. That's 2% and a record high of 13,861. Biggest point gain in almost 5 years. The Nasdaq rose 49 points, 1.8%. The S&P 500 skipped up 28 points, 1.9%. New record there, too. Our editors include John Buckley, Patty Hirsch, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, and Lisa Tucker. Next time on the program, staying at cheap motels just got a lot more appealing.
It's very fresh. I mean, the bed looks inviting. It's white. It is triple sheeted. There are 4 oversized pillows on the bed.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.